only going to put them in perhaps a slightly different context. We're going to be talking about the mathematics behind general relativity, and that's that in what I've noted there, that within the context of mathematics is called differential geometry. So I sometimes think of GR as applied differential geometry. So we'll be talking about mathematical concepts behind GR. So I think this is pretty useful because there's two ways in which you can think about gravity. You're either often practically working with it, doing calculations, in which case you'll often use more the language that you've probably already covered in the first general relativity course. But if you want to sort of start thinking more about, more abstractly about gravity, about the structure of space-time or how that fits into other areas of physics, it's useful, it's very useful to have this concept of the structures and the mathematics behind space-time. So that's sort of the value in what we're doing first. Then I'll sort of go through a range of different topics, as I've called them. I'm going to talk about black holes again, discussing them perhaps from a slightly different point of view, emphasizing more causal structure and maybe more theoretical properties. I'll be talking about sort of Euclidean gravity and why we think about Euclidean gravity. And I'll also cover ideas about this, looking at quantum fields in gravity, although probably focusing more on non-perturbative aspects of quantum fields and gravity, because you know we tend to often think very much about perturbation theory when we do QFT, but there's some really interesting physics in non-perturbative effects. And then right towards the end of the course, I usually take two or three lectures to talk about what I'm labeling there as frontiers. So quite often, I sort of pick a couple of papers and just try and discuss those, sort of work through it. Because what that does is we, you know, over the course of the 3 weeks, we've looked at several different topics. And quite often when you're doing research, you pull together things from all over the place. So it'll be kind of pulling stuff together to sort of see how we use these techniques in practice. So that's the sort of rough, you know, roadmap of what we're going to be doing. But right this first week, we'll be going over some mathematics of GR. So hopefully this will be slightly different from the way you've seen it done last year, whatever, with Neil. So basically, what you'll have discovered is that Einstein kind of took the force out of gravity. He sort of said, no, gravity is not really a force. It's more just about space not being straight. Things move, things are affected by massive objects because the space around massive objects is curved. And so in order to describe the curved space-time, we have to look into the mathematics of how we set up curved spaces. How do we do that? What do we actually mean? And one useful analogy to kind of carry along with you as we're doing some of these definitions is to think about the Earth, because from our perspective, I know we are definitely three-dimensional, but the way we live, you know, is mostly two-dimensional. We live on the surface of the Earth, and that's a curved surface. It's roughly a sphere. And so how do we describe the Earth? And essentially, what we're going to talk about with our definitions is really just going to be formalizing what we intuitively do all the time when we navigate around the Earth. So it's a really useful thing to kind of keep in the back of your mind. So our first thing, definition. I suppose I should give the lecture a title. Let me see, title, lecture one. Our introduction to differential geometry. So the way we describe a curved space is we call it a manifold, and that's just saying, you know, it's not necessarily just a simple flat Euclidean space. And in our context, it's a set of events. So, you know, in mathematics, you'd say a set of points or a set of some particular set. But from our perspective, how we see the world around us is in events. We sort of look at something happening, and it's, you know, it's really what happens, where does it happen, when does it happen? That's what we mean by an event. And the key thing is that it looks locally, just locally, like a flat space. So we know that to be the case for the Earth because Euclid developed his principles of geometry, and they're all about flat space geometry, and that's why we call it Euclidean geometry. So we know that it must look locally flat, but on the bigger scale, not obviously not globally flat. So here we have this sort of notion of this is our manifold, and I've said that it has here dimension n, so just to be general initially, and we sort of have this notion here of r to the n. So we have two sides of the picture. We've got a manifold here, and what we're saying is if we just focus in on some little region, then that maps to some little region in a flat space. So that's what we mean by looks locally like r to the n. How do we formalize that? Well, again, we go back to our analogy of the Earth, and we say, well, if we want to describe our Earth, actually what we use are maps. And we pick up our atlas, times or whatever, atlas of the Earth, and we know that every point on the Earth is covered within that atlas. So we have a collection of flat pieces of paper which all together are covering the whole of the Earth. So the flat pieces of paper are open sets. They're just a little portion of our manifold. We call them open sets UI, and these are called charts. And together with the open set, we have a map from the open subset. So this would be our open subset UI. And we have some little map, let's call it psi I, that takes us from U into an open subset of R to the N. So this gives us what we would think of as coordinates. So this is going back to the more familiar way of labeling our events in space-time. We usually actually label them T, X, Y, Z, T, R, theta, phi. So that's what we mean by the manifold. And we're going to consider what we're going to call C infinity manifolds, which are infinitely differentiable. So this is a nice smooth map, and we can differentiate it, essentially. And so what we do, basically, is we know how to work with Rn, we know what vectors are, we know how to deal with things on a flat space, and all we do is we kind of transport that back up in a very specific way to the manifold. So that's, in a word, very I'm sure pure mathematicians would be slightly horrified about that language, but nonetheless, it's essentially what we're doing. We know how to deal with a flat space, and so we're simply going to use that structure that we already have, that intuition, and lift it up onto our curved space. So we need to, first of all, just, again, a few more definitions. We need to think about functions on the manifold. So we first of all start talking about functions on the manifold. Intuitively, we can sort of see all that means is we take a function, it's got a number at each point on the manifold, at each event, and when we transport down into our local flat space, f has to be c infinity on each of these local charts. So that tells us about functions on the manifolds. That's going from the manifold down to the reals. Then we need to go the other way. So here, we're saying, first of all, we know how to put functions on our manifold. Now we want to do curves. And the reason we want to do curves is it's all very well having this sort of curved space, but we have to know how do we find out if it's curved? How do we put vectors and things on it? And in order, this is our sort of stepping stone to defining vectors. So the picture here, put it over here. Here's our manifold. Here's the real line. Let's just take a little interval in the real line and map to this curve here, gamma. So here, here's our map to the curve. So sometimes you can think of gamma as the map or the actual curve. And then we've got our flat space, which is kind of our underlying our manifold. So here's an open set. Actually, maybe I should try doing it a different color. Here's our open set U, which maps to some open set in R to the N. And so gamma here has some image over here in R to the N. So you can think about this thing over here as taking you from the reals to R to the N. And that's something we know how to do. So we're very confident about how to do that. So we could think of this as, for example, the world line of an observer, x mu of t. So that would be our example of one of these curves. So usually when we're doing gravity in practice, it's this sort of thing we're thinking of. We usually write down, you know, positions as a function of time. So we're often mentally using this this sort of fact that underlying your curved manifold is always locally flat. And so finally, that means we can now define something that's really kind of rather crucial in order to be able to make any progress, and that is a vector. So, you know, how there's sort of several different ways when you first meet vectors. You sort of first meet them either as an arrow, something with a magnitude and a direction. So in that case, thinking about r to the n, that would be, the arrow would be a number which would be representing magnitude, and then a set of angles representing the direction. And so, you know, there we've got a direct geometric notion of what a vector is, a little arrow. However, when you build vector spaces, you tend to build them a little bit more algebraically, and you think about x, y, z, or x1, x2, x3, x4, etc. Some ordered set of numbers which you add, you multiply by scalars, and obey a sort of set of rules. In each case, they're both the same from the perspective of r to the n. But what are they from the perspective of the manifold, the curved manifold? Because if we think about trying to label it, you know, x1, x2, x3, x4, our curved manifold has different charts. So which x1, x2, x3, x4 do we use? It doesn't seem to make sense. An arrow, a magnitude and direction. Our space is curved. How do we know, you know, if we try and draw an arrow on a curved space, how do we know we're drawing something sensible? So both of those are notions of a vector don't seem to work when we go to the curved space. So we have to think about, what do we mean by a vector? Well, the arrow's not bad. It's just that we don't want the arrow to be something lying within our manifold. So here, if we think about an arrow, it's a magnitude and a direction. And so what that translates to is actually tangent vector to a curve. And this is, if we want to think of it algebraically, it's a linear operator. So the image to have is our curve gamma. So this lies in M, a point P. And then we somehow take a tangent to the curve, okay? So what I have to do is I have to persuade you, first of all, this really is a vector space, and then I'm going to tell you that the vector space is not actually living within the manifold. So here, T is the linear operator. Why is it an operator? Well, it's actually mapping functions to functions. And it takes a function f, and gives you the rate of change of f at the point P. So what's going on? Well, if I have a function, any old function, I can construct a map from the reals to the reals simply by taking, first of all, going from the real line into the manifold along the curve gamma, and then back down again by taking my function f. And so this gives me my function f of t, and then I can obviously take df dt. And so this is true for any function And so what that means is, since this happens for all functions, we can abstract out what t is doing. It's sort of taking d by dt. That's what our vector is. It's sort of taking a derivative along the curve. And if we go into a local chart, we can kind of project that derivative along the sort of axes, if you like, of the r to the n. So just remember that this t is defined at p, at a particular point. And so why is, yep?
You wrote there that t goes from c infinity m to c infinity mm-hmm. n. Should that be to r?
So in this, no, because what it's doing is it's taking a function mm-hmm. in this, in c infinity of m, and it's giving you another function, df dt. It's strictly, I suppose, it's only giving it to you at p, right? But, so I'm kind of going to build this up bit by bit. At first, I'm just talking about p. I'm going to say why it's a vector space. And then what we're going to deduce is that you can have different tangent vectors at different points. But essentially, you could think of this df dt here. You could extend it to a function in C infinity of m, which has the value df dt at p. So it's a map. It's not. So I take your point. This is not actually defining a unique map at every point in the manifold, but it is giving you a function or a particular value of the function at p. So I could then, you know, I could sort of imagine doing this at all the curves. I mean, you can sort of see how it kind of extends to C infinity. But that's, yeah, fair point. Because we're only really doing this at P, but the point being that it's taking a function on the manifold and it's giving you at least a value of a different function, potentially a different function on the manifold at the same point. Yeah. I think it's more about kind of abstracting off this step, the fact that it's d by dt, and it doesn't rely on the choice of f. It's got to be true for all values, all functions. So, so just to see why this is indeed a vector space, it's kind of sort of more or less you're kind of deducing the obvious, but if we had two curves, gamma 1 and gamma 2, which intersect at P, is sort of structured to intersect at P, you can see that that's going to give two different tangent vectors. There's one, T1 and T2. And so if I go focus in locally, what I can do is I can use this local flat structure, and I'm going to put this in inverted commas, to sort of add together the two curves. What do I mean by that? Well, what I mean is that if I make P the origin, then I just, in flat space, in my chart, I simply add together the coordinates of each of the curves, and that gives me a third curve, or at least in this case, the curve is in R to the n, and then I look at the pre-image of that curve in the manifold. So here, this gives me a means of adding together vectors in different directions. And of course, I can always redefine my parameterization to rescale my vectors at P. And so what I can do is this builds for me at what we call the tangent space at P, and we label this TP of M. That's the tangent space of the manifold at P. And then the set of all the set of all tangent spaces is the tangent bundle. So to some extent, we often tend to be maybe a little bit ambiguous, not always sort of totally clear whether we're restricting ourselves to a particular point P or looking more generally at the whole structure or the tangent bundle. But the thing that sort of I want to emphasize is that TP of M is a copy of R to the N. So the tangent space at a point is, we just build it up by adding, you know, these different operators, but visually, you know, if we think of it as being a tangent to a curve, we've got just different vectors pointing in different directions, and we're very much talking about vectors in R to the N. This is standard addition, standard vectors. So it's not, the vectors do not live in the manifold. So let's go back to our example of the Earth. And take our point P to be the North Pole. Then here we can imagine approaching the North Pole in two different directions. And our tangent space would then be a flat piece, a flat plane tangent to the sphere at the North Pole. So that illustrates the fact that the vector space, the tangent space, is flat, it's not the manifold, and that it's associated with the point P. So the tangent bundle of the sphere would just be the set of all planes that were tangent at each point on the sphere. So now I want to move to back to making contact with the language that you'll have already seen. So it's a vector space, TP of M, so it has a basis. And in fact, I've kind of already sort of hinted at that by writing that expression there. So this common basis is called a coordinate basis. And that's, we just write that as d by dx mu. And what that kind of means is that if we took, for example, the x-axis of r to the n and looked at its image, if we lift up its pre-image in the manifold, that gives you a curve in the manifold, and then we take the tangent vector of that curve. So that's just d by dx mu. In general, our basis would just be a set of vectors, EA, where A runs from 1 to N, and we could write those vectors in the coordinate basis. So, for example, quite a common one that we use is an orthonormal basis when we have a metric where our EA dot EB, where that dot is really coming from the metric, is either plus or minus 1. So normally, there's sort of something about this language that tends to, or will tend to, just, you know, require just a little bit of thought to make it clear. Notice that T is the geometric object, T is the vector, and T is expressible in terms of a basis, in this case, the coordinate basis. So in this sense, this T mu, these are scalars. So here, T is a vector, and T is TAEA. So this is our basis. These are components. And they're actually scalars. Now, what we often do when we're practically doing calculations in gravity we often actually just write T mu as our vector. So for example, we might write, just to come out from things that you've already done, a covariant derivative, we might write it as the partial derivative plus the connection component. So we write that, okay? And that is where we're writing T as being a vector. And this is known as abstract index notation. So Penrose tried to sort of be very formal about this and clear in the sense that this is kind of what we tend to do as physicists, and it's very useful because we often have to be doing a lot of calculations. And so we need to be able to have a notation that works for us. But mathematically, when you're trying to think about the geometrical structure, you want to think of the vector as being a geometrical object. And so here what you do is you split that out between having sort of canonical geometrical objects, the basis, and things represented by the basis, together with the components of the vector in that basis. And those components are just sets of scalars. So in the first week, typically, we're going to be leaning more towards this notation. I'll try and be clear which one I'm using, but if you're in any doubt, just pop your hand up, ask which one I mean, because it can be a bit confusing, because you're going to see me differentiate these things, and I'm going to treat them as scalars, and you're going to think, hang on, that's a vector, isn't it? Where's the connection? You know, but there isn't a connection. These really are scalars, and the connection, anything geometric and vector-like, happens with the basis. So this is what Penrose just tried to formalize because, you know, in a sense, trying to be clear of the differences in notation between sort of doing practical calculations or, you know, what a mathematician might write down. So that's the vector. We've defined what a vector is, and it's probably a little bit different to what you were doing in the first part of gravity, the first GR course. So at the moment, all I've said is it's this linear operator, which sounds a bit bizarre, and it's talking about tangents. And somehow it's very much more an arrow, the arrow image of the vector. Now, although I mentioned a metric, I haven't actually got a metric so far. So we now need to know what the equivalent of covariant vectors would be, or a covector. And so in this case, more maps. A covector is a map from the vector space to the reals. That's sort of always what a covector is. And we can denote it notationally in a sort of set of different ways. I'll often use this one, Brahn-Ket type notation. But you might also see omega of V, because it's a map, it's taking a vector to a real. And I guess the reason I use this is more because this kind of reminds you that it's a bit like, it's not an inner product, but it's giving you a scalar. It reminds you that it's giving you a scalar. So we denote this cotangent space. It's really the dual vector space at P. So it's TP star of M. And of course, if we have a basis, then we have if we can set up a dual basis, so we simply pick our covectors so that if they hit their partner vector, they give you one. If they don't, if they hit a different basis vector, they give you zero. So for the dual to the coordinate basis, we just write dx mu. So we're going to actually come back to this d, I think, tomorrow. But dx mu this is how it's defined. It's simply saying that if we take our sort of contraction, our map of dx mu acting on dx nu, it is actually just the partial derivative of x mu with respect to x nu. So we're going to meet that in more detail later. And so our basis, we think of a general covector alpha, then it has, again, I'm being very careful with the positioning of indices, but it has components with respect to the covector basis. And so if I write down my components and think about what is this map alpha acting on V, I decompose alpha into its components with respect to the coordinate basis. I write V in with components with respect to the coordinate basis. And I see that all I do is simply sum over the same components, alpha, mu, V, mu. So then that's, now that we've built our basic elements, our vectors and covectors, we form tensors simply by taking tensor products of either multiple vectors, multiple covectors, or mixed vectors and covectors. So that, I'm just going to kind of assume that that's sort of reasonably clear. So coordinate transformations, this is going to be coming back to very much what you've probably already seen. So when vectors and covectors were first developed and tried to be understood, so initially, or very early days, people were trying to think about the distinction between vectors and covectors as coming from the way that they behaved under coordinate transformations. So did they transform in the same way as the basis or against the way of the basis? And so this led to this idea of covariant and contravariant coordinate transformations, and therefore covariant or contravariant vectors. So if we think about our vector, our geometric object T, and think about what it looks like in a local chart. So this would be one particular set of coordinates. And then suppose T lies in some intersection of two different charts. Then I've got two different ways of constructing my geometric object. I've got two different coordinate bases. So I'm thinking here of a, let's say, u primed, and here's my curve somewhere in the intersection. So I've got two different ways I can label my vector. So here, my t prime, mu prime labeling, I know how to relate this operator to this operator because on the intersection of two charts, my coordinate functions are infinitely differentiable. So I know that if I write x prime mu prime, I can write that as a function of the other labels x nu. So I can write that differential operator, d by dx prime, simply as dx by dx prime, d by dx. So this means that this must equal t mu because I've got the same basis here. So I've got the same basis vectors here as I have here. So that is my t mu. And so this gives me my definition of what we would call a contravariant vector. So my basis is transforming as dx by dx prime, but my components are transforming the other way, dx prime by dx. So that's the contravariant aspect of it. And then for covectors, I go the other way. It's sort of the inverse transformation. So this is a covariant. It's transforming the same way as the vector basis transforms. And so this kind of brings together the sort of more old-fashioned definitions of vectors, and also shows how things transform, how the components transform under a general coordinate transformation. So just as a quick check, it's always worth making sure you haven't done anything stupid. Let's take the map that we had of alpha. No, I wrote it somewhere, top board. If we take the map of alpha on V, okay, let me do V rather than T. So this was supposed to be alpha of V, the geometric quantity here is alpha of V. So let's do that in components. Well, I see how my alpha transforms. It's dx prime mu prime by dx mu alpha mu primed. And then I know how B transforms because I just read it up off there. So that's dx dx by dx prime. So here now, if I look at these, I'm contracting over this dx mu here. So that reduces this combination to dx prime mu prime by dx prime mu prime, and that's just the delta, Kronecker delta. So it's alpha mu prime V mu prime. So our expression, remember this was the geometric quantity alpha of V, and we wrote it down in components, and all we're saying is that now as components, that's perfectly well defined. And this could be either abstract index notation, or as indeed it is here, the component notation. Having introduced these basic things, we've just gone and sort of done, probably in rather tedious detail, some fairly basic stuff. All we've done here is said, hey, we've got manifold, how do we define it? How do we construct a vector? What do we mean by a covector? And does it all make sense? And that's really not going very far. This is what often happens in maths. You spend a lot of effort, at least apparently, initially not going very far. But what we've got to now is we've sort of tried to make a link back to the old coordinate type notation, and we've sort of come to the point where we're getting to what we really want to do, which is to be able to differentiate vectors, and this is showing us why that's problematic, as I'm sure you've already seen. So if I want to take a derivative of a vector, and I did the obvious thing, which would be to take a partial derivative in a particular coordinate chart, then I try and look what happens if I make a coordinate transformation or change charts So what happens if I just try and do the naive thing? This is what I would have in one coordinate chart. That would be my U. Let me look at what happens in U prime. I have to, first of all, transform my operator, d by dx, to d by dx prime. And then I take my components and transform them contravariantly in the way that I've just described. And so what I end up with First of all, I take the derivative operator and hit it on V, and that's nice. That's kind of what I want. The upstairs index is transforming contravariantly. The downstairs index is transforming covariantly. So I'm happy with that. But I've also got a derivative of the Jacobian, the transformation matrix here. And so I have an extra piece. And this, I'm not so happy about. So that means that if I want to do a derivative of a vector, I can't do the simple thing. I can't just take a coordinate derivative. So that shouldn't really be a surprise, because all the way through, we've kind of tried to be clear that there are these sort of two parallel pictures going on. There's the manifold, which is the curved blob, and then there's the R to the N, which is the nice clean structure, the thing that we know how to work with. And so anything in R to the N, which would be these sort of operators, is fine, but that's not taking into account the full manifold. And the point of the manifold is that we tend, if it's curved, we tend to need these different overlapping coordinate patches. So we need to be able to define things that make sense no matter how we choose to describe them, no matter how we choose to transport down to R to the N. So as you know, there are different ways of doing this to make it geometrical. The one that we use most in gravity is what I wrote down here. That's the covariant derivative, which requires the definition of a connection. There are also other ways you can take a derivative, and that's what I'll start with tomorrow. And essentially, what these other ways do is notice this thing here is symmetric in mu prime and nu prime. They kill this piece off, so they somehow anti-symmetrize. So we'll come back, as I said somewhere, to this D, I think right back up there at the top. We're going to talk about how to take a derivative of covariant anti-symmetric tensors, which are called forms, and that's the exterior derivative. That's explicitly anti-symmetric and kills that term off. And then we'll also talk about a Lie derivative, which is taking vectors with respect to a particular direction or vector field. So those are ways that you can take well-defined geometrical derivatives without using the connection. So we will do the connection, but first we'll do these other geometrical derivatives, the Lie derivative and the exterior derivative, and then we'll talk about the connection, and we'll first do it in generality, talk about what we mean by a connection, before talking about what we really do in gravity, which is the Levi-Civita connection. Okay. Wow, I didn't think I'd get up to 10.